It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, pasta is always a good choice for, say, a Valentine's Day dinner. If you're tired of the same boring pasta dishes, Lydia Bastianich will be here to help jazz them up. First, federal and local authorities are investigating the spread of far-right extremism in law enforcement and the military. The pro-Trump riot and storming of the Capitol on January 6th didn't just include white power and anti-government groups like the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers. There were also off-duty law enforcement officers and current and former members of the military. Over a dozen members of law enforcement are currently under investigation for their alleged involvement in the Capitol riot. Another dozen Capitol police are under investigation for allegedly encouraging the rioters. Our next guest, an expert in extremist ideologies and homeland security, says extremism is a long simmering problem in the U.S. military and that the Capitol insurrection was a boiling point. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about extremism in the military and or law enforcement? What do you think should be done to tackle the problem? Are you a member of law enforcement or the military yourself? What's your reaction to what we're seeing in the news? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Heather Williams is a senior policy researcher at RAND Corporation and a professor at the Pardee RAND Graduate School. She previously served as deputy national intelligence officer for Iran at the National Intelligence Council. Her work focuses on ideological extremism. Heather, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we go into law enforcement and the military, can you talk about the far-right extremist threat in the United States? Have we been taking it seriously enough in recent years?
Well, that's a great question, Rob. And we've actually seen the FBI in the last few years emphasize that there needs to be more attention put on far-right extremism. Over the last 5 years, we've seen far-right extremists be responsible for more fatalities in the United States than any other type of extremism. So surpassed, for example, that connected to Islamic extremism. And the last 2 years or so, there has been a greater emphasis inside the FBI and parts of the intelligence community to look at this problem.
Let's look now at law enforcement. First of all, as I mentioned, more than a dozen off-duty law enforcement officers allegedly part of the events at the Capitol on January 6th. What do we know about extremism and law enforcement?
So in terms of the law enforcement connectivity to that event, there's been kind of 39 names at this point that I've seen circulated suggesting that those are active duty law enforcement officers who may have been present at the rally. That does not mean that all of those individuals entered the Capitol. There are four individuals who have been charged with actually violating the law and entering the Capitol. So there's one more officer who there maybe is evidence that they were also in the Capitol. But we are still talking about a relatively small number of individuals who have been confirmed to have participated in the entrance of the Capitol, and then it's unclear exactly what they did when they did so.
And then in the military, we have the Secretary of Defense now, General Lloyd Austin, saying, hey, entire Department of Defense, we're going to review the problem of extremism in our ranks. Small, the Secretary of Defense says, but not small enough. What do we know about extremism and far-right extremism in the military?
Well, we don't know enough, and this is true for law enforcement as well. I mean, one of the biggest questions here is that we don't know how prevalent these problems are in police departments and in the military services. There haven't been a lot of research efforts to kind of look at the prevalence, and there's more transparency, I would say, probably on the part of the military than there are the part of police departments. But there isn't a lot of information to understand how common this problem is and how often it leads to the removal of individuals.
Talking to Heather Williams from the RAND Corporation, she focuses on ideological extremism in her work. We're talking about the potential for far-right extremism in the U.S. military and law enforcement. Heather, when it comes to trying to prevent people who are involved in actual extremist groups from being involved in these organizations, I mean, a law enforcement officer off duty can go and participate in politics. They could participate in a protest legally, I think, and without jeopardizing their duties at all. Where is the line drawn?
Yes, so there's some precedent that as public servants, there are kind of tighter boundaries for what's appropriate behavior for a law enforcement officer than there might just be for an ordinary civilian. So even though the activity may not be illegal and an officer may not be breaking the law by engaging in these activities, it may still be appropriate to question their continued employment in that kind of a position of trust and of public service.
Can you talk some about the history of extremism within law enforcement and the military? This isn't an entirely new issue, right?
Certainly not. And I think particularly when we talk about the U.S. criminal justice system and police, there is an institutional history of racism. There were racist purposes in which police initially served to enforce laws related to slavery and then Jim Crow laws. So, it would be great if there was a clear line between what was unconscious bias of police officers, what was racist activity, racist sentiment among police officers, and then what constituted explicit extremism, but there's not. So, the fact that we've had a problem with racism probably also means that there is a sliver of this problem that has slipped into more what we might consider extremist activity and even violent extremism.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Bob is with us in Columbus. Bob, hi.
Hi. I have a disagreement with the perspective that you're bringing. First off, as a member of the armed services for close to 20 years, you take an oath, and the whole idea of oath keepers is to you take an oath and you're expected to live up to the terms of that oath for your life. That's not extremist. I took an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States and defend it against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And during the Trump administration, I was on high alert for what I would have considered an unlawful order. And, now I'm on high alert for what I am concerned to be unlawful orders from the Biden administration, because they're both using executive powers outside the Constitution. That's not extremist. And our legislators should be expected to uphold that same oath. They're supposed to be upholding the Constitution, not circumventing it with bypassing election laws or actually advocating for policies that are clearly unconstitutional.
Bob, thanks for the call. So Bob referring to the group Oath Keepers, that is how they bill themselves as living up to the oaths they take in the military. Can you talk about the Oath Keepers a little bit?
So the Oath Keepers is an interesting movement, and I think it's important to keep in mind that not everybody who may have at some point kind of signed on to the Oath Keepers has the same perspective as to what it is. The Oath Keepers attempt to recruit individuals with a pitch that I think many of us are sympathetic to, with the idea that, you serve this higher concept of the U.S. Constitution, of our democratic processes, and that you would kind of be available, you'd be willing to stand by to defend those things if they were in a time of crisis. They elicit a membership fee, and they collect some personal information about people who they can pitch that effectively to. And it is a pitch that often does resonate with armed forces members or with police, because it sounds at face value consistent with the oaths that they make when they enter into their jobs. However, the actual leaders of the Oath Keepers and some individuals who are more, let's say, hardcore members of the Oath Keepers have more aggressive and nefarious intent that would actually involve sometimes using force to circumvent or intervene or otherwise stand in the way of democratic processes in the United States.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Heather Williams, senior policy researcher at RAND Corporation. She's with us to talk about extremism in law enforcement and the military. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this a problem that concerns you? If you've been a member of law enforcement or the military, have you seen efforts to recruit people to extremist organizations, maybe among your ranks? Call in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with extremism expert Heather Williams. She's explaining why right-wing extremism is a concern in the U.S. military and law enforcement. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. Heather, before we go back to our callers, I know I've talked to people about groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and one challenge is, yes, there are people who are identified members of those groups, but then there might be people who meet them online, sympathize with them online, follow them online, maybe have limited or no direct contact with them, but are inspired to acts of violence by that experience. Do we see similar things with far-right extremism in the United States?
Yes, I think there is similarly sort of a spectrum of activity that individuals engage in. Some of it just expressing support, and promoting these ideas, and maybe sometimes even going on to produce propaganda. And a very small number of individuals are actively involved in acts of violence.
Let's go back to our callers now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hey, this is a little bit of a tangent, but I was wondering, since we've been in combat for so long, 16, 17 years now, and we're giving veterans, you know, I think a duly well-deserved a heads up and leg up when it comes to joining police departments. Are we now putting so many combat veterans into the police departments that they're treating almost any situation as combat? And a lot of these people who are joining militias and whatnot are also people who are used to dealing with problems in a very physical, combative way.
Tom, thanks for the call. Is there something, I guess, in a militarized mindset, I think Tom is asking, that might lead people to see extremism and extremist violence as a solution to a political problem?
I mean, I hope not. I do think that there's a different problem there, which is, are police officers responding to situations in a way that may escalate or may be too militant an approach? I don't think that that is the same as the concerns we would have about extremism, which still represents a very small number of both soldiers and officers by and large. Now, those small numbers kind of taint the whole quite often and do a lot to undermine public trust in any police officers, and that's problematic. But I think that the issue of ensuring that we have adequately addressed the trauma that comes from combat and just how police are trained and primed to go into situations is a different problem, and there are different things that could be done to address it.
Thanks for the call. Dale joins us next in Merrill. Dale, hello.
Yep. You there?
Yep. Go ahead, Dale. I hear you.
So I'm a law enforcement officer, been in law enforcement since the 1980s. And when I was first hired, the Posse Comitatus, which was a version of sovereign citizens, were active in Wisconsin. And literally part of my screening process was asking me questions about extremist views, anti-government views. So this is not a problem that's new. And as a law enforcement officer and a supervisor, the key to eliminating extremist people from within law enforcement is right at that line supervision level. The sergeants and lieutenants that work with the officers in the field should be able to identify people who are problematic, whether it's extremism or abusing policy or being physically abusive. And I mean, that's the key to ferreting out these problems within law enforcement. And I'm assuming the same for the military.
Dale, thanks a lot for that call. And Dale points us in a great direction. Heather, what can, say, a police department do, as Dale was saying, to screen people for these risks at the outset?
Yes, I think that's a great point, both in terms of the fact that police departments do have it within their capability to try to identify individuals that could present a risk, and then with good leadership can respond to those problems as they manifest. I think the problem is that we have close to 18,000 police departments in this country, and they do things differently. And some do these better than others. Some are more desperate for officers and may be willing to settle for a candidate who really doesn't meet the standards that we should expect from police officers. And as I mentioned, I don't think that this problem is something endemic to law enforcement, but even in a very small numbers, you know, a few bad apples can kind of be caustic in how people see the whole system and the trust that someone has when they are approached by police or when they need to engage police for help.
Thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it at 800-642-1234. So say a department hasn't had this kind of screening in place for years and is looking at this to say, okay, we don't think this is a big problem. We want to make sure it's a non-problem in our agency. How do they start to play catch up if this isn't something they've been tracking for years?
So I think that there are some basic questions you could just ask that to help understand someone's personality and their outlook and how they treat others and whether they hold discriminatory or hateful views against a group of people, be it based on race or be it based on gender. That is one mechanism. Understanding what a law enforcement officer's history is important to know. There is often not a there's not a national database, for example, that helps us understand when officers have been fired for misconduct. And some departments may not be as thorough as they should be in understanding why an officer has moved from a department to another. And so to understand that there wasn't a concern about this officer that prompted them to be previously dismissed or fired is another option.
Just briefly, in our last few moments, do we need more data and analysis and collection of data on these issues?
Well, I'm a researcher, so my answer is always yes. We certainly need more data. And I think what we're seeing with the military in the stand down is a huge acknowledgement of that. I mean, Secretary Austin's stand down, I think, one, reflects the seriousness to which he sees this problem, but also reflects the fact that the military doesn't necessarily know what to do next. You know, I spoke to what the responsibilities might be of a police officer, but for military members, for uniformed service members in all services, they are prohibited from actively being involved in any kind of extremist activity. So the rule is on the books, but we don't have a good understanding of how those sorts of rules get enforced and what's the accountability for when they are broken. And that holds for police as well.
Heather, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Heather Williams is senior policy researcher at RAND Corporation. She's previously deputy national intelligence officer for Iran at the National Intelligence Council. She joined us for a look at far-right extremism in the U.S. military and law enforcement. As of yesterday, more than 5,900 people have died from COVID-19 in Wisconsin since the start of the pandemic. Nearly 25,000 people have been hospitalized. It was a year ago today that Wisconsin confirmed the first case in the state. That infection was contained, but the pandemic found its way into every community. Rob Mentzer brings us this audio overview of a year in the life of a pandemic.
Thank you all for being here. I'm Satya Rhodes Conway, the mayor of Madison. Earlier today, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services announced that we do have a person with the novel coronavirus here in Dane County.
The infected patient is the 12th person in the U.S. confirmed to have the novel coronavirus, a new respiratory illness that has killed hundreds of people, mostly in China.
It's reasonable to assume today's news will not be the last positive case we hear about in our region.
Health officials have confirmed two new cases of coronavirus in the state of Wisconsin.
Confirmed cases in Wisconsin of the respiratory disease COVID-19 is up to six.
Eight new cases have been reported today in the state, bringing the total to 27.
At least 34 active cases of COVID-19. Milwaukee County.
With great sadness, last night we confirmed the first two deaths in Wisconsin related to COVID-19. And by the time we woke up this morning, there had been a third.
Under Governor Evers' order going into effect tomorrow, the essentials stay open. Grocery
essential businesses like grocery stores, hardware stores, and pharmacies will be allowed to stay open. People don't need permission to leave their homes, but are only allowed to do so for specific things.
So right now we're stocking up on essentials that are starting to run out at the store at the moment.
I thought, well, I'll get one pack of toilet paper. No, it's all gone.
It's a shock to see everything cleaned out.
Just hours after Governor Tony Evers issued an order to suspend in-person voting tomorrow, the state Supreme Court overturned that order.
We only have five polling places in the city. and I've been out here for almost 2 hours.
I'm not used to having a vote like this.
People have been in pretty good spirits, happy to be able to vote, and at the same time, doing it in a way that's really safe.
Yes, self-monitoring. No. You too. Thank you.
Today, I had my first friend die of COVID. Not acquaintance, not patient, but friend.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court has struck down Governor Evers' Safer at Home order. The governor told reporters last night,
"They have provided no plan.
After 2 months lockdown, it's refreshing to see something open again.
I mean, I've had a couple phone calls on my personal phone already this morning saying, are you guys open? Yep. So they're coming."
Our hospitalization rate continues to look like a mountain, and we're still climbing that mountain. We really need help from the people of Wisconsin to help us shut this down.
We're in the surge. Our numbers are at an all-time high in our system.
Nurses are picking up extra shifts, working 16-hour days, up to 8 days in a row, because they feel guilty that their coworkers are working short in an already stressful situation.
Our surge plan expands into the garage. It opens up more beds. We're expanding into lobbies. We're putting people where we wouldn't normally put patients.
Well, the vaccine is here.
The beginning of the end to COVID-19.
Vaccines are on the horizon. There's going to be an end date to this pandemic.
This is going to take time.
Health officials say it will take months to get shots in the arms of the general public.
It's really
public.
Easy to start thinking that, you know, it's over. Like, let's celebrate. And it's just, you know, not quite yet.
Follow more news about COVID-19 at WPR.org. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Public television cooking host Lydia Bastianich is back with us to help us cook with pasta. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show, a Republican state lawmaker joins the program with reaction to the latest back and forth on the state's mask mandate. That's Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Valentine's Day is next weekend, and if you're looking for a nice dinner to make at home, you can't go wrong with pasta. Sure, you could cook some spaghetti and top it off with some kind of sauce from a jar, but you'll score bonus points if you do it from scratch. Not only will it taste better, it's actually not too hard. If you're in the mood for a pasta dish that's a little more outside the box, our next guest has some ideas to consider during this edition of Food Friday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite pasta dish? Do you have a secret ingredient or special tip or sauce that you want to share? Do you have questions for our guest? Do you need some help? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lydia Bastianich is with us, chef, restaurateur, author, and Emmy-winning host of the public TV show Lydia's Kitchen. Lydia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Pleasure being with you, Rob.
Do you, I don't know if I should even ask you this. Do you have a favorite pasta dish or is it too hard to choose?
You know, I do. I mean, I do, but it's not one that beats them all. It usually is, you know, depends the situation and basically depends on the season. What is out there that's great? I mean, you know, fall truffles are in. Boy, do I like tagliarini with truffles. In the summertime, I love linguine clam sauce and so on down the line.
How about, do you have a favorite dish for when it's really icy cold outside like it is right now in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, yes, you know, there's those hearty, if you're talking about pastas, a nice carbonara, which is simple to make. You know, a carbonara is basically some dry pasta. And the sauce is made out of onions, bacon, guanciale, which is Joel bacon, but if you don't have that, regular bacon is A-okay. And you sort of saute that in a little bit of oil. You make it into a sauce. You cook your pasta. You drain your pasta, put it into this sauce, toss, toss. And then just before pulling it out, you add to it an egg yolk, toss, toss, toss. You add some great grated Grana cheese, and you got yourself a marvelous dish for this kind of weather. And it's 4 ingredients.
That sounds fantastic. Now, let's take a trip down the grocery aisle, Lydia. A lot of us are going to make pasta with dry pasta. You have some thoughts. When we look at the pasta, what are we looking for to get the best taste and texture?
Well, what's important about dry pasta is to make sure that it is made from 100% semolina flour. So semolina flour is durum wheat. It's made out of durum wheat. There's regular white wheat, which is a soft wheat, you know, and the starches are, it's a higher proportion of starches. Durum wheat has more proteins, more gluten in it, let's put it that way. And therefore, dry pasta traditionally is made by 100% of semolina flour. Once you have that is a given, then you look at the pasta. You want the pasta, of course, not to be blotchy, to be a uniform color. It shouldn't be shiny. You know, it's a little opaque. It's okay because you want the pasta to be rough. You don't want a smooth pasta, dry pasta, because smooth dry pasta, the sauce just slips right off. You want that roughness into a pasta, which actually is dependent on the dyes that they use to cut the shapes. So a soft dye. Traditionally, they used to use wooden dyes. Then they went on to brass dyes. Then they went on to stainless, but stainless dyes are not used anymore. So look at that pasta. It should be whole. It shouldn't be all that shiny. It shouldn't be very floury. It shouldn't be floury, because once you see pasta or to the touch is floury, that means that it has that it's a bit old. And basically, those are the ingredients that you're, the qualities that you're looking into a pasta. And then, of course, the shape. I mean, there's more than, I think, 220 different shapes of dry pasta. So you have a lot to choose from.
Okay, Lydia, sometimes when I make pasta, if it's long pasta, I'll break it in half. And then I don't know, do I put oil in? Do I put salt in? How much water? Give us the basics of boiling up that dried pasta once we've made our selection.
No breaking pasta. Pasta, you know, Italians, we like our spaghetti just the way they are. You dunk them in the water. You have to have an abundant amount of water. For a pound of pasta, you know, I mean, three, four quarts of water. It has to be salted. And that's you know, relative. Depends. If you are watching your salt, then you can diminish it a little bit. But the water has to have some salt. Otherwise, the pasta becomes flat. And you can never recuperate that flavor. You know, if health-wise, then you do what you have to do. So you need your boiling water. You need your salt. The salt you put in just before you put the pasta in. You put the pasta into boiling water. Cover it. Try to get it back to boiling point as soon as possible, because otherwise, you know, if it sits there on the bottom, it's going to stick to each other. So you put it in, you give it a twirl, you put the cover back on full speed of the fire, and you let it come to a boil. Once it boils, then you can uncover it and continue to mix it, and never put oil in the water that's cooking the pasta, because again, oil will coat your pasta and will sort of inhibit the sauce to sort of grasp onto your cooked pasta. So a cooked pasta should be, you know, al dente, have a little bite. So don't overcook your pasta. That's another cardinal sin. If you overcook it, then, you know, the sauce just will slip right off. You know, there's an old saying in Italy, if you throw the pasta to the wall and it sticks, it's done. So you want it to be a little sticky and rough. So no oil, and you know, no rinsing, for the same reason. You know, you don't want to rinse off that little sort of starch residue that when pasta cooks, the porousness of the pasta where the sauce goes into. So you have your sauce, you drain your pasta, do not rinse it, put it into the sauce, undercook it a little bit. Even, you know, we like it, Italians like it al dente, but even you at home, undercook it a little bit and finish cooking it in the sauce. Always save a little bit of the pasta water, because if you don't have enough sauce, or if your pasta needs a little bit more cooking, that pasta cooking water will save you. You can always add that to the pan with the pasta and the sauce.
Talking to Lydia Bastianich on this week's edition of Food Friday. She's helping us make better pasta dishes. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Pat is with us in Duluth. Pat, hello.
Hi. I'm a big fan, Lydia, so thank you for helping with this question. And I hate to say, but I've been breaking pasta, so I already know not to do that. Usually I do vegetable dishes, but in the last couple months, I've tried to do shrimp scampi, and I've been using linguine. And the result I'm getting is very little flavor. And I wondered, like, how you make shrimp scampi.
Okay. So, you know, cooking the pasta, you heard it. The sauce, you know, you have to put things in there. And shrimps, you are right. You know, they will not necessarily release a lot of flavor to dress all the pasta. So you can do two things. Once you, if you buy it cleaned and skinned, the shrimp and all that, then you don't have the shells. But if you have the shells, you know, like, put them to boil with a little bit of water, not too much, and maybe some herbs, thyme and whatever, and you get yourself a little bit of court bouillon, a little bit of a kind of shell fish broth, if you will. But then you have to start your sauce with some bases. I mean, is it garlic or onion? You know, I am not sure. Whichever one you prefer. But put enough of that, and you put that in the oil. And then put a little bit of peperoncino, you know, the peperoncino, the hot pepper. And in it, you can put a few branches of thyme. You can put in some scallions. You know, so you can build that flavor. The shrimps, what I usually do, you know, they go in the last minute because shrimps take 2-3 minutes to cook. So you have all the bases. You have that little court bouillon. Put that into the sauce. Let that bubble away and season it, taste it. That should develop quite a bit of sauce. And then, you know, just before you drain your pasta, the shrimps goes into the sauce. And while you drain your pasta, don't overcook the shrimps. While you drain your pasta, the shrimps should be cooking. You add the pasta to this shrimp and sauce. You toss it, chopped parsley, and you should have a great dish.
All right. Good luck, Pat. We are talking to Lydia Bastianich, public TV host of Lydia's Kitchen. We are upping our pasta game today. By the way, Lydia's got three recipes for us. We've got them at WPR.org/Food Friday. Tomato sauce, a good basic tomato sauce, spaghetti and pesto trapanese, and baked ziti. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite way to make, serve, and or eat pasta? Have you ever made your own noodles? Are you looking for ways to solve some boring pasta problems in your own kitchen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, check out one of those recipes or two coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk about pasta with Lydia Bastianich, chef, restaurateur, author, Emmy-winning host of the public television show Lydia's Kitchen, author of a number of cookbooks as well. You could join in at 800-642-1234. It's your favorite pasta dish. What pasta dish do you need help with? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Check out WPR.org/Food Friday for a few recipes from Lydia, including this one. Lydia, let's check one of them out. Spaghetti and pesto trapanese. Now, our producer, Bill Martin, says this is one of his favorites among your recipes. He's made it a couple times. He says it's fantastic. Tell us about this one, please, Lydia.
Oh, that's one of the easiest recipes.
Ooh, I like that.
And it's a Sicilian recipe. So pesto, we all know pesto. You do your garlic, your basil, your parsley, and your oil in the processor, and you got yourself some pesto. The Trapanese pesto is a different collection of ingredients. So it's not a green pesto, and it's you don't need to cook it. In a blender, it is finished. So get yourself some nice ripe cherry tomatoes. The riper, the sweeter, the better. Some toasted almonds, some garlic, some parsley, some basil, some peperoncino, and olive oil. And you process this in a food processor until you get a pesto. You know, you get that kind of creamy consistency like you do of a regular pesto. Except it is kind of a pinkish red sauce. And you cook your pasta separately. You know, you cook your pasta, you drain it, and you when the pasta is nice and hot, save a little bit of water. When the pasta is nice, of the pasta cooking water, that is, when the pasta is cooked, put it in a warm bowl and just spoon in the pesto trapanese. And you just toss, toss, toss. You can put some chopped parsley on top. You put some grated grana cheese. Always save a little bit of the pesto separately. Don't put it all at once because you don't want it too wet, too saucy. You can always add sauce. That holds for any dressing of pasta. Don't always put the whole sauce into the pasta. Always save some. And you toss, toss. And it's ready to eat. You have your cheese, and the pasta is delicious. And Trapani is a city on northern Sicily, on the sea, and they make this pasta trapanese, pesto trapanese with the pasta. And I had it there when I went to visit. Actually, I went to learn how to make couscous. I wanted to know how to make couscous, and this wonderful woman. She cooked lunch for me, and this is what she made. And I says, oh boy, I'm going to take this with me. And this was quite a few years ago. And people love it because you don't need to cook anything.
Again, we've got that recipe. Pasta. Oh, the pasta, of course. We've got that recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday, straight from Sicily through Lydia Bastianich to your kitchen. We got an email from Grant who wants to know the best method for making home handmade pasta without a machine. What would you tell Grant, Lydia?
Well, you need to get into it. So the ingredients are those. You could begin to make the ingredients in a bowl, a nice glass bowl, large enough, or you could make a well on a board, a dough kneading board, if you have, or even you know a counter, a nice either marble, granite counter will do. So you make a mound of flour, and you make a well into it, and you beat some eggs, whole eggs, depends whichever recipes you use. It could be all egg yolks, very rich pasta. It could be whole eggs and egg yolks. It could be whole eggs, egg yolks and water, whatever. But the idea is that you flavor it. So pasta, you can even make it much simpler. You can make pasta with just flour and water, a little bit of salt. It won't have that texture, that flavor if you put eggs. But let's go back to that well. You put the eggs in the well. You get the flour. I like to sift my flour. You make a well. You put the eggs, 2, 3. You kind of whisk them a little bit in the middle there. You can whisk them right in the well. Put salt. I put a little bit of olive oil. And I begin to add the flour into that well with a fork and sort of mix. I have a little bit of water on the side. And so it goes. You pull the flour, you mix it into the wet. So the wet and the flour until you have a homogeneous dough that feels good and that doesn't stick to your fingers or to the table or to the board. That it still kind of allows you to knead it. And what's important in making fresh pasta is that kneading process. And that kneading process is where you really build the glutens. You bring out the glutens in the flour. And it's, you know, that sort of gives the pasta, the fresh pasta, the resiliency. But you can roll it very thin and it's still resilient. So the working of the pasta, and once you have worked it, and you know, you'll ask, okay, how long do I need this pasta? I think 20 minutes is a good time, good timing. And then you put it, you wrap it in saran wrap and you let it rest. You can put it in the refrigerator or you can let it rest out. If you put it in the refrigerator, you can last even overnight. It's okay. But if you're going to work at it, you know, you can leave it out and give it half an hour to rest and then go back to it and roll it and shape your pasta.
Wonderful. Let's go back to our callers now. Dion is with us in Green Bay. Dion, hello.
Hello, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to ask about, Dion?
Hi, I want to ask about, I'm a big fan of yours too, Lydia, and I'm a self-proclaimed chef with my family and friends. However, when it's time to make a pasta dish, I always find myself in the aisles of a store looking for pasta sauce. So I don't feel like a chef then because I'm buying sauce. However, do you got any tips for homemade pasta sauce or red sauce?
Well, good news, okay. Dion. First of all, we've got a recipe from Lydia at WPR.org/FoodFriday. Lydia, go for it.
All right, Dion. Dion, that's nice to hear that you love to cook. First of all, if you're in those store aisles, there is a Lydia sauce, which is delicious and completely organic and good. So look for Lydia sauces. But sauce is very easy to make at home. And I suggest, you know, sometimes the complication of should I make a tomato sauce or whatever, a simple marinara sauce is just as good and it will serve you the whatever you want when you want to make pasta. The question is of buying good plum tomatoes or San Marzano tomatoes. And I recommend canned. You know, in the summertime, if tomatoes are ripe and nice, it's good to make with fresh. But otherwise, canned tomatoes are great for making a sauce. Make sure the best are the San Marzano tomatoes, which are those tomatoes that are long. They look like they're shapy, you know, like a sexy tomatoes, if you will. And you want to buy them whole in their juice. So you don't want chopped, you don't want purees. You want whole San Marzano tomato in the juice. Cento, which I know is all over the United States, has a good product. So you have your can of tomatoes, the plum tomatoes, the San Marzano. You open that and you crush the tomatoes in that sauce with your hands, or you can use a vegetable. What do you call it? The mill, a vegetable mill to bring your tomatoes to. Do not put it in the blender because it incorporates too much air and it changes the color and it's no good. So either
about
your hands.
30 seconds left, Lydia, to sum up some advice.
Okay, so you have the tomatoes in a pan, olive oil, garlic, sliced or crushed garlic, peperoncino. You throw this, when that is kind of flavorful, you throw in the tomatoes, a few bay leaf branches, salt, let it cook for 20 minutes. You got yourself a great sauce.
That sounds fantastic, Dion. Hope that helps. And Lydia, thanks for joining us. Appreciate talking to you again.
All right. Bye-bye.
Lydia Bastianich is a chef, restaurateur, author, and Emmy-winning host of the public TV show Lydia's Kitchen. She joined us to help us jazz up our pasta dishes. We've got three recipes at WPR.org/FoodFriday from Lydia, including that tomato sauce she was just talking about, spaghetti and pesto trapanese, and baked ziti. We didn't even get into that. You can find it and make it. Give them a shot. Let us know how they turned out. Coming up Monday on Central Time, there's been a big back and forth over Wisconsin's mask mandate. We'll find out where we landed and what could change over the next few weeks. We'll get the latest on the Foxconn saga and what's actually happening on the site in southeastern Wisconsin. Plus this month's edition of Mondays with Mike with all the latest news from WPR. That and more Monday on Central Time. The pandemic season has been a big season for s'mores. That's according to Hershey. The chocolate company saw a big s'mores season of sales for their chocolate bars, bigger than usual, longer lasting than usual. Makes sense. Campfires, good socially distanced outdoor gathering, and there have been reports of big sales of backyard fire pits. But what about making s'mores indoors, say on a really cold day? I've tried. It's not the same. Central Time producer Tim Peterson has tried too. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Rob.
You had a magical childhood indoor s'mores recipe. What did you do?
Yes, and the secret of it is chocolate graham crackers. We just would skip the chocolate bar step altogether. Found that if we put a marshmallow on half a chocolate graham, throw it in the microwave, watch it expand to where it's about going to blow up. We quick jerk it out of the microwave, throw the other top of the graham on it, and you got a s'more.
I've tried a lot of methods of making indoor s'mores. None of them are good. Partly, I think it's the campfire setting. My problem with microwaving marshmallows is it makes it clear what an alien substance a marshmallow is. You can get over that microwave marshmallow?
I think as a kid, you can get over a lot of alien-type experiences.
All right. I don't know. It's really hard to clean up forks if you use them to hand roast over the stove. So I'm still experimenting. Tim, thanks. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.